Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is a very auspicious occasion. This is the annual joint meeting that we hold with our sister society, the Royal Medical Chirurgical Society, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you all this evening. I understand that there have been no apologies received. And I think it being a special occasion, we can dispense with the reading of the minutes. Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome our speaker tonight, Professor Sir Kenneth Kalman. From Professor of Oncology via Chief Medical Officer to Chancellor of the University of Glasgow, his achievements are well known to us. Perhaps less well known is that he had an appointment to the Victoria Infirmary for a brief period while he was postgraduate dean. We feel that it is unlikely that you have reached your apotheosis in the Kalman Commission, but who knows? Sir Kenneth promotes the involvement of the humanities in medicine, and this reflects his own long-standing enthusiasms for humour on the one hand and Scottish literature on the other. His subject tonight is Scottish literature and medicine. In this, he's going to be assisted by another guest, Dr. Rona Brown. We also welcome her. She is a lecturer in Scottish literature at the University of Glasgow, and her specialisms range from the medieval period to the 18th century, and she is involved in the recently launched Centre for Burn Studies at the University. We look forward to this address with great anticipation. Sir Kenneth, Dr. Brown.
President, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here. My involvement with both societies has been long-standing, so it's nice to be part of it again. My colleague Rona here is going to do some of the readings with me, if that's all right. She's going on to another event in Byers Road after this. If any of you are going past Byers Road and would like to give her a lift, she'd be delighted. And if any of you are going a little further to Annie's Land Cross, I would even be more delighted if you could take me too. I've just come from Sheffield and Manchester by plane, I think, today, where my little daughter was graduating MPH. So it was quite nice. And Anne's gone off to Kelvin Court, and I came here. So she's got the car, if you like. So I would really be very grateful if you could give me a lift. Anyway, it's lovely to be here. The interest in this subject, mine, has been quite a long-standing one, because it links the history of Scotland and the history of medicine together with its literature. And what I'm going to do tonight is slightly more of a commonplace book, really, rather than a formal study. Although you should know that not only is Rona a lecturer, she's a colleague, because I'm doing an MLit in the Department of Scottish Literature, just to give me something to do in the evenings. Now, it's to try and bring the history of medicine together with the history of Scotland and Scottish literature that I wanted to do this. And you can see as I go through, I hope, that doctors, medicine, health and disease are portrayed in different kinds of ways. And there are lots of, I think, interesting lessons to learn. Because we've only got perhaps 50, 60 minutes, I may have left out some of your favourite authors, for which I apologise. However, you do have a task as part of this. This is an educational centre, you have to remember that. And that is, if you do find any interesting instances of the relationship between what you read in the Scottish literature and medicine developed broadly, please let me know, because I'm always looking for them. So, in the words of Burns then.
But how the subject theme may gang, let time and chance determine. Perhaps it might turn out a song, perhaps turn out a sermon.
So Scottish literature in this sense is defined pretty broadly. And I use the word sometimes macar, which is a particularly Scottish one for a poet, but one which was originally Greek. And the Dunbar's Lament of the Macars is one of the first times this was used. And of course, storytelling has got a long history in most cultures, and Scotland is no exception to that. So the range and diversity of stuff makes it difficult to put it all together. But what I'm going to say a little bit about is the people of Scotland, health, doctors, including medical students and research, disease, and medicines and healing. And finally, I'll try and bring that all together in terms of what can we learn about the state of Scotland's health. So if I turn first to the health of the people of Scotland, a review of the Scottish literature and poetry over the last six centuries really gives an interesting glimpse of the life of the people of Scotland and the character of its people, and ranges from Barber's Bruce through to Train Spotting. The first of these reflects a theme which goes right through Scottish literature, that of freedom, and the stirring words of the Bruce is a remarkable statement of that principle.
Ah, freedom is a noble thing. Freedom maketh man to have liking. Freedom all solace to man giveth. He liveth at ease that freely liveth. A noble heart may have nain ease, na ellis noch that may him please. Give freedom fail ye, for free liking is yearnit our all other thing, na he that aye has liveth free.
It's a lovely statement, that. In The Annals of the Parish by John Galt, describes 18th century Scotland in an Ayrshire parish. A wonderful series of anecdotes about the life of the minister in the village and the comings and the goings. It's delightful, full of humour, full of the little incidents that make up village life. And for example, there's a wonderful description of the first tea drinking in the village, hidden behind a hedge so that no one else could see it. In Neil Gunn's book, The Silver Darlings, he describes the life of fisher folk in the very north of Scotland, the hardships and the difficulties and the problems of illness, which we'll mention later in the book. Even more powerful in terms of the people, I think, is Sunset Song, Lewis Grassic Gibbon, which is this wonderful evocative tale of Angus countryside, shows how hard life can be, but also how satisfying. The pleasures of the land, the difficulties with the land, and the heroine puts it very clearly in terms of her love and her loathing of it. It shows how difficult it is to move beyond where you are and to improve yourself, but the spirit of the countryside takes over. Turning to more modern times, Wax Fruit by Guy McCrone. Many people have read Wax Fruit in the room. I mean, if you haven't, it's really worth a look at. Describes a family at the end of the 19th century moving into the 20th century. Coming from a rural background in Ayrshire, moving into Glasgow, first into its heart and then out to the West End, and the changes in status of the family from the rural environment to middle class industrial Glasgow. A wonderful description of how things have changed. And if you turn to the beginning of the 20th century, William McIlvenny's novel, Doherty, looks at life in the shipyard community struggling with the problems of depression, unemployment and living standards. And at the very beginning of the book, Tam Doherty is born, and the words of the doctor who delivers them are really well worth recording.
The laughter ebbed to a still contentment. Dr. Allen leaned into the cushion of heat behind him. His professionalism being disarmed by tiredness, he saw the scene as a fortress of people built protectively and perhaps hopelessly around a child. He remembered how at the birth he had put the child to the bottom of the bed, a parcel of useless flesh, while he concerned himself with the mother. It was Mrs. Ritchie who had scalped him into life. She would talk about that, and it would swell in the telling, would become a story of a life stolen from the jaws of death. As the doctor lifted the glass again to his mouth, it was a private toast. With it there went a solemn wish for the kind of fulfilment to this beginning that they dreamt of. It was wished for all the more intensely because he could not for a second begin to believe in it.
It's a lovely piece about the doctor, and indeed this hope that this wee boy will do well. The modern Scottish novels are very forthright in saying things about how we live. And I think the most powerful of these is Trainspotting. How many of you actually read Trainspotting? It's interesting. How many of you seen the film? Yeah, well, it's good, good. Well, you'll get the flavour of this and you'll really know it. But I think it's a remarkable book. And if you forget all the F words and actually get into the story, it's quite amusing, I think. And here are two extracts to give a flavour, a contemporary flavour of the health of the people of Scotland.
Lenny went down to the pub and sat at the bar with his daily record and a pint of lager. He considered lighting a cigarette, then decided against it. It was 11:04 and he had 12 fags already. It was always the same when he was forced to rise in the morning. He smoked far too many fags. He would cut down by staying in bed, so he generally didn't get up until 2 p.m. These government swines were determined, he thought, to wreck both his health and his finances by forcing him up so early.
It's beautiful. Ventress had got HIV infection like most people in Edinburgh through the sharing of needles while taking heroin. Ironically, prior to being diagnosed HIV positive, he had kicked the junk, but now was a hopeless pisshead. The way he drank indiscriminately, occasionally stuffing a pub roll or a toastie into his face during a marathon drinking bout, meant that his weakened frame was easy prey to all sorts of potentially killer infections. During his period of socialising with me, I confidently prophesied that he would last no time at all. And these extracts show just how far we still have to go in improving the health of the people in this country. The information is available, the knowledge is clear, but behaviour change just has not occurred. And finally, one of the things I'm about to do is look through the Bruins and Oor Willie over the last 60 years or so. A glance at these shows a remarkable social statement of what Glaswegians in particular were like, with a Dundee overtone over in the Sunday Post over the last 50 or 60 years. I mean, it's just remarkable when you think about the Bruin family. So let me turn briefly to health. Once again, it's possible to look through a very wide range of material to get a glimpse of the changes in health. And interestingly, tobacco features early in the writings, first James IV on his Counterblast Against Tobacco, and another poem by Robert Ayton also. And again, this is 1570 to 1638 on tobacco. I've discovered two full-length poems, both in the 17th and 18th century, on health alone. Wonderful descriptions of syphilis and bent noses and everything, gloriously done. And public involvement in health was also seen to be very important. And one of the most widely read books in the 18th and 19th century was William Buchan's Domestic Medicine. And indeed, Burns refers to Buchan in some of his poems. And it describes in a very popular way what individuals can do to treat illness. Robert Ferguson, and this young lady happens to have her PhD in Robert Ferguson, writes beautifully on a number of things, one of which is colour oysters, or fresh oysters, to improve health.
Come pree, frail man, for gin thou art sick, the oyster is a rare cathartic, as every doctor patient got lick to cure his ails. Whether you hae the head or heartache, it aye prevails. Ye tipplers, open all your poses, ye who are foused with plucky noses, fling out your craig sufficient doses, you'll thole a hunder, to fleg awa your simmer roses, and naething under. When big as burns the gutters rin, gin ye catch a drookit skin, to lucky middlemas slope in, and sit foo snug, our oysters in a dram o' gin, or haddock lug.
It just wants to make you eat oysters, doesn't it? Burns, I've rediscovered a wonderful range of things. Only a couple we'll mention this evening on his writings on health and medicine. But one poem in particular, the address to the Unca Gid, gives very real mourning, which is very, very modern.
See social life and glee sit down all joyous and unthinking, till quite transmogrified their ground debauchery and drinking. Oh, would they stay to calculate the eternal consequences, or your more dreaded hell to state damnation of expenses?
Then gently scan your brother man, still gentler sister woman, or they may gang a ken and rang, to step aside is human. One point must still be greatly dark, the moving why they do it, and just as lamely ye may mark how far perhaps they rue it. It's very modern that. We begin just a little glass here and there, and it just slowly sinks, and you don't know why you've got there. I mean, what more could you? It's a modern version of how to change health, I think. Margaret Oliphant was one of the most extraordinary women writers of her day. Born in Scotland, she moved to Liverpool and then to London, and during her life wrote around 90 books. They're, I think, very easy to read, full of good sense, and reflect the values of Victorian culture. The Chronicles of Carlingford are her perhaps most famous now, set in England. But one of her earliest novels, Margaret Maitland, reflects the changing world in early Victorian Scotland. It's set in a small town within a day's ride of Edinburgh. It's a story of a spinster who looks after a young woman and the complex interactions between her and the community. From a health point of view, however, it gives an interesting, the most interesting part of the story is the local young laird. He is introduced to the village, which has one end of it has an area which is poor, destitute, rather run down. Listen to this dialogue.
Mr. Allen's eyes shone out like a light, shone out a light like the sparkle of a fire. Pestilence and violence, dirt and poverty, he cried out. Splendid Miss Maitland, and on my own estate too. Almost too good news to be true. We'll have it immediately. I'll ride down today and begin. Crewe End, there is an expressive odour about the very name.
So he sets about to changing the village. He introduces a series of morally edifying lectures, which all the men in the village have to go to, poetry and philosophy. And, of course, it completely disturbs and destroys the village. And this top-down approach is absolutely hopeless. So as he disturbs village life, he recognises his folly and makes amends by engaging a Glasgow merchant who sets up a mill just outside the village, and he then plans a model village. And just as the story concludes, it begins to be a success and provides opportunity and employment. Very much the story of Robert Owen and Neil Lanark. But it's beautifully described how he completely fails to change things. And finally, in this section, McGonagall. He writes wonderfully on so many subjects, but from a health point of view, his poem on the demon drink takes a lot of beating.
Oh, thou demon drink, thou fell destroyer, thou curse of society and its greatest annoyer. What hast thou done to society? Let me think. I answer, thou hast caused the most ills, thou demon drink. Thou causeth the mother to neglect her child, also the father to act as he were wild, so that he neglects his loving wife and family dear by spending his earnings foolishly on whiskey, rum and beer. And after spending his earnings foolishly, he beats his wife, the man that promised to protect her during life. And so that man would, if there was no drink in society, for seldom a man beats his wife in a state of sobriety.
It's a lovely line. I mean, seldom do I beat my wife in a state of... I don't mind beating her on other occasions, but not in a state of sobriety. These are just a few of the issues that come up in the literature of Scotland, and there was a clear assumption within that about what determined health. An appropriate diet, exercise, avoiding smoking, drinking, sexual promiscuity, real employment, and social class issues. And these determinants remain precisely the same today. It's, again, as you look through the literature of Scotland, a variety of references to doctors and how they practice and what their value was. Some of them may seem a little old-fashioned now, but they continue to reflect on some of the important values, I think, of the medical profession. The earliest reflect the problems of doctors being effective, and Henryson, who's 1420 to 1490, writes beautifully on this, and the futility of doctors is well recorded.
Though thou be blind, or have ane halt, or in thy face deform it ill, say it come not through thy default, nae man could thee reprise by skill. Blame not thy lord, say is his will, spurn not thy foot against the wall, but with meek heart and prayer still, obey and thank thy God for all.
It's the Lord who caused it, but we cannot blame him for it. It's a wonderful bit of the Scottish Presbyterian background, I think. One of the most interesting ones I came across was a thing called the Goloshan, which is a medieval mystery play performed, I think, right up till the 19th century. It represents good and evil, but in the midst of it, a doctor appears to heal the sick person. This is, I think, a fascinating reference to medicine and some of the language used, particularly how the doctor has travelled in other lands to learn his trade, showing the very wide range of culture reflected in Scottish literature.
Here comes in as good a doctor as ever Scotland bred, and I have been through nations a learning of my trade, and now I've come to Scotland all for to cure the dead. Once I was dead, sir, now I am alive. Blessed be the doctor that made me revive. We'll all join hands and never fight more. We'll all be good brothers as we have been before.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Robert Ferguson, again, Rona's particular interest, wrote a poem called Braid Claith. Good braid claith that you put on. And it shows how a good suit can make a doctor even better.
Braid claith lends folk an uncle he's. Makes money kale worms, butter fleas, gives money a doctor his degrees for little scathe. In short, you may be what you please with good braid claith. For though if you had advised a snoot on as Shakespeare or Sir Isaac Newton, your judgment folk would hae a doot on, I'll take my eighth, till they could see you wi' a soot on o' guid braid cleith.
Very contemporary issue as to whether doctors should wear suits and ties or not. And certainly in the wards you must roll up your sleeves, chaps, and wash your hands. And no ties. The problem with infection, of course, is always a serious one. In The Silver Darlings, which I mentioned earlier, by Neil Gunn, Finn, the hero, walks many miles over a two-day period to find a doctor of what he, because he thinks his wife's got the plague. It's likely that this was around 1832, and he arrives in Wick and meets the doctor, having walked all this distance. He happens to find someone who can help him. He's exhausted, and his wife, the doctor's wife, actually gives him something to eat, and then he goes back home. That's an interesting example of how you had to get to the health service in days before we had ambulances and all sorts of other things. One of the most interesting, of course, is a short story by John Brown, 1810 to 1882, entitled Rab and His Friends. Have any of you read Rab and His Friends? Marjorie knows all about this one. Yes. And I'll say a little bit more about it later. But it's the story of a medical student in Edinburgh before the days of anaesthetics. Rab is a dog who accompanies James, a carrier, everywhere, and indeed even comes into theatre. The patient is Ailey, who's married to James, and is obviously unwell with cancer of the breast, and she has her first discussion with the doctor.
Next day, my master, the surgeon, examined Ailey. There was no doubt it must kill her, and soon. It could be removed. It might never return. It would give her speedy relief. She should have it done. She curtsied, looked at James, and said, "When?" "Tomorrow," said the kind surgeon, a man of few words. She and James and Rab and I retired. I noticed that he and she spoke little, but seemed to anticipate everything in each other. The following day at noon, the students came in, hurrying up the great stair. At the first landing place, on a small well-known blackboard, was a bit of paper fastened by wafers, and many remains of old wafers beside it. On the papers were the words, "An operation today, J.B. Clerk."
This very brief exchange between the patient and the surgeon I've used on a number of occasions in audiences like this, particularly with younger audiences, to say that was absolutely appalling. He should have spent 15 minutes telling her the 26 complications of this and that. And particularly if I have a nursing audience, they're furious that the surgeon should say that. There is, of course, another interpretation, and that is that they trusted each other. And when she said when, and he says tomorrow, she says thanks, I know what you mean. And you can interpret it both ways, but it's an interesting sort of discussion point. Moving on to the 19th century, there's a lovely book called Gillespie by J. McDougall Hay, describes some of the problems in a small community and the central role of the doctor within this. And the description of the work of the doctor, I think, is fascinating.
McLean, a tall, broad, wiry man, was the light of the town, a skilled practitioner with a wide parish under his hand. He grudged no service and brooded on his cases as he walked about the parish, a friend of the landed gentry, a greater friend of the poor to whom he rarely sent an account. Kyle asserted that he'd seen the doctor greeting like a wain for some young man or woman whose case was hopeless.
It's a nice phrase, that. There's another one which we'll mention later. Of course, A.J. Cronin wrote a lot about doctors. Adventures of a Black Bag were, of course, transcribed into Dr. Finlay of Tannock Brae. And the interactions between the gruff Dr. Cameron and the exuberant and naive Dr. Finlay embraced a generation of viewers, me included, in the 50s and 60s, and explained clearly what the life of a doctor was like in a small community and the ways in which a doctor could help and the limitations. Medical students are another interesting subset of this. And one of my favourite books is The Adventures of Roderick Random by Tobias Smollett. He had been a surgeon's apprentice, has the hero confirming that he was able to bleed and give a clyster, spread a plaister and prepare a potion. Smollett himself was a friend of the Hunter brothers, and Roderick Random shows some of his experiences are related. Roderick begins his career in a northern university, studying Greek, mathematics, moral and natural philosophy, but does not like logic. He has an interest in belles lettres And that's interesting because Adam Smith was particularly interested at the time in Glasgow and has a talent for poetry. Following this, he joins Mr. Lancelot Crabb, a surgeon in town, as an apprentice. He claims a knowledge of pharmacy and a little surgery, and while this is inadequate, the surgeon needs him to do all the dirty jobs. So not a lot has changed, really. But he leaves this post and goes to London, taking with him some clothes and
a case of pocket instruments, a small edition of Horace, Wiseman's surgery, and 10 guineas in cash.
He decides to enter the Navy as a surgeon and as first to pass the examination at Surgeon's Hall. When he arrives for the examination, a young man has just come out, and the crowd succeed in finding out all of the examination questions. At length, the beadle calls his name, and he enters the hall to be faced with a dozen grim faces sitting at a long table. Again, not a lot has changed, he said. He was first asked where he was from, and when he answered Scotland, the reply was,
"We scarcely have any other countrymen to examine you here. You Scotchmen have overspread as of late as the locust did Egypt."
It's beautiful. The questioning proceeds, including how to deal with the wounds of the intestine. It ends up with the examiners arguing with each other, and he was sent from the room. I mean, again, not a lot has changed. Happily, however, he passed. One interesting example of the life of a medical student relates to that of women in medicine. And I came across a novel called Mona MacLean. Anybody read Mona MacLean? Not even Marjorie. Written in 1892 by Margaret Todd, a medical student and doctor associated with Sophia Jex Blake and other women in the 1900s studying medicine. The subtitle is Medical Student, and it's written under the pseudonym Graham Travers. It begins in London as the results of the intermediate MB are posted, and Mona, a student at University College, has failed again. The scene is typical, with crowds of students trying to see who's passed and who's failed, and she's devastated. So she returns to Scotland and the family, where she spends several months thinking about what to do. She inevitably meets a young man who is also doing medicine, but she doesn't reveal that to him at the time. But it contains a series of very interesting comments as they discuss things. "Woman," was the reply, delivered with a courteous bow, "have no power. They have only influence."
Doris flushed and then said serenely, "We won't dispute it. Influence is in the soul, of which power is the outward form.
And again, as a natural consequence, the supply of medical women will exceed the demand in the next 10 years in this country. After that, things will level themselves, I suppose. But at present, if a woman is to succeed, she must be better than the average man. Whereas at present, we're getting mainly the average woman. And of course, the average woman is inferior to the average man."
Heretic.
I mean, it's a lovely interaction about... This is not me, remember. This is not me saying this. And she then gives one of the best reasons I've ever heard for studying medicine.
"It's perfectly awful to think how helpless people are who are quite outside of the profession. I think it's worthwhile studying medicine, if only to be able to tell your friends whom to consult, or rather, whom not to consult."
Isn't that nice? And hands up who have not used that in the past. She, of course, returns to London, is greeted by the younger medical students as something of a hero. She passes, gets a first in physiology, and the gold medal. She eventually marries her admirer, and now both doctors, they set up practice together. They didn't set up practice in Harley Street as advised, as they were...
"They were far too enthusiastic to forgo the early days of night work and of practice amongst the poor."
Interesting choice. And the book ends with a scene which demonstrates the essence of needing women doctors. Ralph, her husband, sees a young girl as a patient. As she enters his consulting room, she bursts into tears. He looks at her carefully and says, "I think," he said kindly, "you would rather see the doctor who shares my practice." And he rose and opened the door. Mona looked up, smiling. "Mona, dear," he said quietly, "here's a case for you." I mean, it's lovely. So both patient choice and patient's needs being satisfied. Let me move on to research. It's a fundamental part of modern medicine. It's difficult to consider the future without it. It's been described in the literature in a number of ways. The classic, of course, is Jekyll and Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson.
That night I had come to the fatal crossroads. Had I approached my discovery in a more noble spirit, had I risked the experiment while under the empire of generous or pious aspirations, all must have been otherwise. And from these agonies of death and birth, I had come forth an angel instead of a fiend. The drug had no discriminating action. It was neither diabolical nor divine. It but shook the doors of the prison house of my disposition. Hence, although I now had two characters as well as two appearances, one was wholly evil and the other was still the old Henry Jekyll.
And here, of course, Stevenson describes how an individual can change from one person to another, and he uses a chemical means to do it. James Bridie, of course, well known to audiences, people in this room, one of those most interesting playwrights of the 20th century was, of course, a doctor, and his play, The Sleeping Clergyman, which is a lovely play to reread, takes us through the story of a family and their relationships. And within that family, there's a series of doctors, one of whom eventually discovers the cure for a major pandemic. It describes the importance of research, the arrogance of doctors, their compassion for individuals and the public, and shows, I think, the complexity of being a clinician. On the one hand, wishing to push forward research and improve care, and the other, a willingness and need to look after individuals. I recently read Poor Things by Alistair Gray. Anybody read Poor Things recently? It's an amazing book, actually. Alistair Gray develops a theme which raises hackles in Glasgow in the early 1800s, namely the reanimation of corpses by Glasgow anatomists, and tries out on young criminals who were hanged. Here Gray, and it's a very complex story, and it's difficult, it's not a summarisable story, has the corpse of a young woman resuscitated after she's drowned. And the twist is that she's also pregnant, and the baby is alive, so the brain is also transplanted into the woman. And it's a very complex but very interesting one. The best one, however, and I hope you will agree that this is almost the best in the whole talk, the way we think about research is brilliantly noted in a short poem by Jimmy Black as he considers research.
Transmit this advice, Lord, to all would-be wains who hope soon to sample this earth's joys and pains. Direct them to shun scientific creators who tinker with test tubes and strange incubators. When into this life you have a notion for coming, just try to make sure that your ma's a woman.
I mean, it's a beautiful last line, that, actually. And Burns, of course, always has the last word on this as he reflects at the end of To a Mouse.
But och, I backward cast my ee on prospects drear, and forward though I canna see, I guess and fear.
So that there are difficult things about research, and I'm looking for more. Interesting, I haven't found a good modern book in which DNA technology is used. It must be there somewhere. If you find one, let me know. Diseases. The description of diseases is absolutely fascinating, and some of the earlier poems in particular are wonderful. In Dunbar's Lament for the Mackers, he shows, as we heard before, this inevitability about illness and death, which comes through much of early writing.
I that inhale whiz and gladness, am troubled now with great sickness, and feeblet with infirmity. Timor mortis can turbat me, the fear of death disturbs me. In medicine, the most practitioners, leeches, surgeons, and physicians, themselves redeed may not supplee. Timor mortis can turbat me.
The weakness of medicine at the time. In addition, his verse on headache is absolutely splendid.
My heed did yak yesternight, this day to mark that I may micht. So sair the may grime does me mend ye, piercing my brow as ony gen ye, that scant I look me on the licht.
A wonderful description of migraine there. There was very little that doctors could do to conjure disease away from individuals. And those of you who've heard me before in cartoons or some equivalent cartoons about the difficulties there. The description of individual diseases are relatively easy to come by, and one of the most powerful is that of syphilis, described in Ramsay's poems. Mental disease, again, sometimes not easy to find, but James Hogg's Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner. This is a very disturbing but very powerful book about how an individual is driven by religious certainty as being one of the elect and carries out a series of crimes and acts of depravity. He's accompanied in this by a person whose character and appearance change. Eventually it becomes so bad that the individual commits suicide. As a description of serious illness, perhaps alcohol-related, perhaps personality disorder-related, it's very powerful indeed. And I've already mentioned John Brown and Rab and his friends, how Ailey has breast cancer and has to go to theatre. She lies on the table without an anaesthetic and has a mastectomy. I can do no better than ask Rona to quote the words of the story itself.
The operating theatre is crowded, much talk and fun, and all the cordiality and stir of youth. The surgeon with his staff of assistants is here. In comes Ailey. One look at her quiets and abates the eager students. That beautiful old woman's too much for them. They sit down and are dumb and gaze at her. These rough boys feel the power of her presence. She walks in quickly but without haste, dressed in her neckerchief, her white dimity short gown, her black bambazine petticoat, showing her white worsted stockings and her carpet shoes. Behind her was James with Rab. James sat down in the distance and took that huge and noble head between his knees. Rab looked perplexed and dangerous, forever cocking his ear and dropping it as fast. Ailey stepped up in a seat and laid herself on a table, as her friend the surgeon told her, arranged herself, gave a rapid look at James, shut her eyes, rested herself on me and took my hand. The operation was at once begun. It was necessarily slow, and chloroform, one of God's best gifts to his suffering children, was then unknown. The surgeon did his work. The pale face showed its pain, but was still and silent. Rab's soul was working within him. He saw that something strange was going on, blood flowing from his mistress, and she suffering. His ragged ear was up and importunate. He growled and gave now and then a sharp, impatient yelp. He would have liked to have done something to that man, but James had him firm and gave him a glower from time to time and an intimation of a possible kick. All the better for James. It kept his eye and mind off Ailey. It's over. She is dressed, steps gently and decently down from the table, looks for James, then turning to the surgeon and students, she curtsies and in a low, clear voice begs their pardon if she has behaved ill. The students, all of us, wept like children. The nurse happed her up carefully, and resting on James and me, Ailey went to her room, Rab following.
It's a very, very powerful story, that, which I think bears reading partly because of its historic value, but also how disease is managed. There's another one not dissimilar to that called The House of the Green Shutters, and Marjorie's read that one too. Others read that one. I mean, it's fascinating just to go through this one. In The House of the Green Shutters, written by George Douglas Brown, remarkable again for the description of the problems of breast cancer. Janet's heart was rent for her brother, but the frenzy on her mother killed sorrow with a new fear.
"Janet," smiled Mrs. Gourlay with insane soft interest. "Janet, do you mind your nicht lang syne when your father came in with a terrible look in his een and struck me in the breast?" "Aye," she whispered hoarsely, staring at the fire. "He struck me in the breast. But I didn't ken what it was for, Janet." "No," she shook her head. "He never telled me what it was for."
"Aye, mother," whispered Janet. "I've mind o' it."
"Weel, an abscess of some kind formed. I kenna weel what it was, but it gathered and broke and gathered and broke till my breast's near eaten away wi' it. Look," she cried, tearing open her bosom, and Janet's head flung back in horror and disgust.
"Oh, mother," she panted, "was that what the wee clouts were for?"
"Aye, it was that," said her mother. "Mony a clout I had to wash, and mony a nicht I sat lonely by my cell, plastering my withered breast. But I never let onybody ken," she added with pride. "Nah, I never let onybody ken. When your father nipped me wi' his tongue, it nipped me wi' its pain, and women, it consoled me. Aye, aye," I used to think, jibe a wa', but I hae a friend in my breast that'll end it some day. I like it to keep it to mysel. When it bit me, it seemed to whisper I had a friend that nane of them kenned o, a friend that would deliver me. The mair he hadgered me, the closer I hugged it, and when my heart was breaking, I enjoyed the pain o' it."
the patient uses breast cancer as a way of dealing with many other problems, and she knows that her cancer will be the one thing which will release her from the other difficulties in her life. It's a very powerful ending to the book. Childbearing and the problems of children loom large in many of the books. For example, in Sunset Song, the birth of Jean Guthrie's daughter is well described. And Helen Cruikshanks writes a beautiful prayer for women who cannot bear children.
O thou who dost forbear to grant me motherhood, grant that my brow may wear beneath its maiden snood love to distressed mankind and helpful sympathy for all whom fate doth bind in sorrow's company.
And Hugh MacMurnaghan has a couple of interesting ones. One is called The Glen of Silence and describes the problem of intrauterine death.
Every doctor knows it, the stillness of fetal death, the indescribable silence over the abdomen then, a silence literally held because of the way it stands out in the auscultation of the abdomen.
And his wonderful couplet on childbearing and its consequences bears repeating several times.
Millions of women bring forth in pain, millions of bairns that are no worth haying.
The number of times I've said that about my children. I think nearly the final area now is medicine and healing. There are quite a lot of comments in the literature about medicines, particularly herbs and healing. And one of the earliest, again, is by Henryson called The Practice of Medicine. There's no doubt, therefore, that early on in the 5th and 16th century, the value of such herbs was known and recognised. Other therapeutic agents were noted at the same time, particularly alcohol. And in the Satire of the Three Estates, there's a beautiful reference to the value of alcohol.
Elk man drink to his marrow, I you pray. Tarry nocht lang, it's late in the day. Let some drink ale and some drink claret wine. By great doctors of physic, I hear say that michty drink comforts the dull engine.
Good glass of wine helps everything. Burns, in Death and Dr. Hornbrook, illustrates some of the medicines which might be used, but more importantly, he pokes fun at the impotence of doctors.
And then the doctor saws and whittles at all dimensions, shapes and metals, all kind of boxes, mugs and bottles, he's sure to hay their Latin names as fast he rattles as ABC. That's just a swatch of Hornbrook's way, thus he goes on from day to day. Thus does he poison and kill and slay, and Will's paid for it. He stops me on my lawful prey with his damned dirt.
You know, doctors are not all that good. However, there's another verse in this poem which I had missed until literally 3 or 4 days ago when I reread it again. It shows the immense scientific nature of Robert Burns. Even then, them that canna get attended, although their face he ne'er had kenned it, just shite in a kale blade and send it. And soon's he smells it, both their disease and what will mend it, at once he tells it. Well, it's easy, really, isn't it? You know, just get a cabulation, quick shite, off to the doctor, and you'll get the noses. I mean, that's what we do, isn't it? And I hadn't realised that Burns had recognised this such a while ago. One of the major themes in The Talisman, Walter Scott, is the healing, and I haven't said much about Scott, but he's pretty good too. Another one in a moment. The healing of King Richard of England by an Arabian physician. The physician who's been befriended by Sir Kenneth, a Scottish knight, turns out to be Solomon the Great. However, he does manage to heal King Richard using a magic stone and some potent drugs. And this magic healing stone, according to Walter Scott, was in fact returned to Scotland. It's said to be the Lee Penny and is somewhere near Biggar, even as we speak. Such magic and healing stones were well known, and in St Finlan's in Perth, these stones are actually very nicely displayed. Healing wells are also very relevant, and in the annals of the parish, this is also referred to. Such healing wells, sometimes known as Clutie wells, are seen around Scotland. Any of you seen the one up near Culloden? It's an amazing well. When you drive past it, the trees are covered with clutes, where people go and tie these to leaves, to the trees, and that will heal them. And if you haven't done it, you should go. And my arthritis got better almost immediately. But in The Surgeon's Doctor, and I know that Marjorie's read this one well too, Scott defines the country doctor.
Such a rural man of medicine is usually the inhabitant of some pretty borough or village, which forms a central part of his practice. But besides attending to such cases as the village has to afford, he is day and night at the service of everyone who may command his assistance within a circle of 40 miles in diameter, untraversed by roads in many directions, and including moors, mountains, rivers and lakes. For late and dangerous journeys, rendered at the expense or risk at least of his own health and life, the Scottish village doctor receives at best a very moderate recompense, but still the man of science cannot complain of inactivity or want of practice.
And one of the reasons for raising that is that Marjorie Allison, who's sitting there, will be opening a small museum in the Wilson. But it's your museum in the Wilson building sometime soon. Which will illustrate
micro museum,
but actually will illustrate a lot of the work around what the country doctor did. So I encourage you to go and see that after March. For another view of health and the effects of poor living, Lucky Spence's Last Advice by Alan Ramsay takes some beating. Lucky Spence is a prostitute who gives her advice to her followers. It has a message for the good customers, a message for the bad customers, and a reference to the sayer snout in it, of course, is syphilis.
My benison come and good doers who spend their cash and bods and whores, may they never want the whale of cures for a sayer snout, foul for the quacks where he the fire smoors and puts nae out.
My malison light ilka day, and them that drink and dinna pay, but tack and snack and run away, may it be their hap, never to want a gonorrhea or rotten clap. I mean, it's magic to see that. It just sort of hits you out of the poems. To become slightly more serious for a moment, the settings of illness are sometimes a subject of important poems and writings, notably recently by Douglas Dunn, who wrote some wonderful poems in a little book called Elegies.
She sat up in her pillows receiving guests. I brought them tea or sherry like a butler, up and down the 13 steps from my pantry. I was running out of vases. More than one visitor came down and said, her room's so cheerful, she isn't afraid. Even the cyclamen and lilies were listening, their trusty tributes holding off the reel. Doorbells, shopping, laundry, post and collars, and 26 steps up the stairs from door to bed, 2 times 13's unlucky numeral in my high house. And visitors 3, 4, 5 times a day, my wept exhaustions over plates and cups, drained my self-pity in these days of grief before the grief, flowers and no vases left. Some sat downstairs with a hanky, nursing a little cry before going up to her. They came back with their fears of dying amended. Her room's so cheerful, she isn't afraid.
And finally, another couple of wonderful lines by McDermott giving a fascinating insight into the human body.
I wish I kent the physical basis of all life's semen, airs and graces.
It's lovely that. So let me just try and summarise. I think what I hope these little bits of literature have shown is that it's possible to look at how doctors have operated over the years, what health has been like, what illness has been like, and the messages I think are really pretty strong. And if we want to change health and want to make better doctors, then all the lessons are already there. So from a historical perspective, Scotland's got a good many things which determine good health, pleasant climate, wholesome food, a passion for freedom and equality, a practical bent and a liking for education. Why should Scotland's health be poor then? Perhaps there is a prior question, and that is, has Scotland's health always been bad? And in the words of Burns, facts are chills that win a ding and down are be disputed. And the interesting answer to the question is no. From comparative studies and the data that I've been able to find show that until the beginning of the 20th century, Scotland was healthier than England as measured by height and weight, crude mortality rates, infant mortality rates, and even dental health. What's surprising is that around 1903 to 1908, the time of the Boer War, just post-Boer War, when England could not get enough recruits because of their poor health, things began to change. And England's health seemed to have improved dramatically well, Scotland stayed at about the same level. And it's only post the beginning of the 20th century that the really bad habits and obesity and drink and smoking and all the other bad things seems to come in. And it's never quite caught up. But if you look at Sunset Song, for example, the rural life, good food, a little porridge, fish, a lot of exercise, you know, it's not a bad, healthy lifestyle. But it's changed badly, and train spotting right at the beginning showed how wonderfully badly it changed. So the message is clear: if we do want to improve health in Scotland, then we need a combination of changes in lifestyle and social and economic circumstances, good employment, a clean environment, good housing, education, and access to a public health service, both to protect health and treat illness. We've got them all, and we could do a lot better. So thank you for listening to Rona. May I also thank Rona very much for joining me this evening. Thank you very much.
Sir Kenneth and Dr. Brown have indicated their willingness to take questions or at least comments.
Since you were kind enough to mention my name, I will pluck up the courage to make a comment. I thought that was very, very fantastic, but it's a field I'm very interested in. However, one thing you didn't mention are these marvellous statistical accounts, which I guess are literature. And, you know, I've had to plough my way through the one at the end of the 18th century and then the ones at the beginning of the 19th century. And they're written about all the different counties in Scotland. And there's some fabulous information about the health of the community in the statistical accounts. In fact, some enterprising lady has just written a little book called Tales from Statistics. I can't remember either the title or her name, but it's fascinating. And I thought, gee, I wish I'd done that, because it's such a wonderful thing to do. So maybe she'll go on and do the 1838 statistical account. But there's wonderful descriptions of the health, the lifestyle. And the thing that strikes me about their lifestyle is, A, they walked like you wouldn't believe they walked. Enormous exercise. And they ate very sensibly. And they didn't eat rubbish. So I don't know how you're going to change our lifestyle.
They are remarkable bits of information. This evening, I didn't want to go until midnight for obvious reasons, but they are hugely valuable, particularly in terms of diet, and I think there's probably a whole chapter on diet. Ferguson, I think it is Ferguson, who wrote that bit about Dr. Johnson and St. Andrews, didn't he? Johnson came up to St. Andrews and got an honorary degree, if I remember rightly. It didn't seem to like the food. And Ferguson writes a poem about the kind of food he might have, and it's wonderful. And there are several poems on weddings and what they ate at weddings, and there's a whole, I think, chapter or two on what people ate, and generally it was actually very good. And they walked enormous distances, and they were out in the sunshine all the time, and it was great. And we changed it all. Somehow.
Yeah, not to school anymore.
No, I know. Well, I mean, that's another very good example of it. Yep.
I suppose as Scottish doctors, we believe rightly that there's something distinctive about Scottish medicine. Is that reflected by the place of medicine in Scottish literature? Is there something unusual about Scottish literature in that regard, or is it typical of European literature?
I'll maybe ask Rona to see if she's got a comment on that, but one of the things that has really interested me about this is there something special called the Scottish doctor? As there might be in terms of the Scottish engineer, for example, you know, in Star Trek, it's always Scotty who's there. And I think there might be, and just giving that quote from the country doctor and one or two of the others, there's a sort of particular, they were highly dedicated, out there at all times of the day and night, travelling quite wide distances to get to patients. Greatly concerned about their patients crying at times because they were upset with what happens. So there might be something which we might describe as a Scottish doctor. I haven't got to the end of that yet. I've still got two more years to do in this. Sorry. And my supervisor hasn't seen me for a day or two. And you mustn't tell him. I think there is something called the Scottish doctor, which is probably distinctive. And we'll need to find out about that. Do you have any comments on that?
I think especially in the 19th century there's a real interest in the doctor, and especially because we've got Bridie, who is a who is a writer and a doctor. We've got this conflation quite often that we don't get in other literatures. I think that's probably true to say.
So whether it's very specifically a character, there's some character about it, I'm not sure yet, but I think there might be, in the same way that the Scottish engineer went around the world, the Scottish doctor did the same.
Professor, to hear you talk about sexually transmitted infections was fascinating for me. I'm semi-retired now, but one of the things that I always hoped would happen would be that one of my patients would come into the clinic and say, "Doctor, it's the joppish." Now, this word is in the Scottish National Dictionary, and it came into Scots in about the 16th century from French. Now, one of the classical symptoms of gonorrhea is dysuria. Now, the French way of describing that was chaud de pisse, hot piss, and chaud de pisse became joppish in Scotland, in Scots. But it never happened, and it wouldn't happen now because I'm semi-retired.
You'll need to write that to me. I was down in Dumfries the other night at the Crichton campus, and they gave a similar wee talk, and somebody at the end got up, and I've identified him subsequently, who sang me Dr. McGregor and his wee black bag, which is a wonderful thing, a Will Fife thing. And to show the extent of my communication skills, he was sitting beside a chap called Ian Carmichael, who's a GP in Castle Douglas, who was in my year. And I managed to get through Roger Quinn, Ian Carmichael's phone number. I phoned him and he said, yes, it was a rector. He's a minister next door to me. I'll give you his phone number. I phoned him last Sunday and he's transcribed from his record of Will Fife of Dr. McGregor and his wee black bag, and it should be on my email sometime this evening. And you've got to do things like that to find out these. So I really would like a little note on that. That's a good one. Did you know that one? No, see, there you are. That's a beautiful one. So any odd things like that, odd in the nicest way, then I think it's really quite nice to hear. Joppish, wonderful.
You referred there to O.H. Maver, James Bridie, and I wasn't wanting to raise that, but because you raised it, I just wondered whether you had the opportunity to evaluate the place of Scottish or other doctors like Conan Doyle, who turned to writing, and what particular contribution from a medical standpoint they injected into the writing that might be helpful or otherwise.
A number of other people have done this in the past, and there are books around which you can get on this. And I think they do inject something slightly different. I mean, Bridie, Cronin, Somerset Maugham is another one. And he writes very interestingly about things. And people quite often who've been medical students may not turn out to be doctors, do write in interesting ways about it. And I think that'll be another section of my little thesis, actually. Thanks very much. You're making it worse for me all the time. that will be doctors who've written. And some, Leo Absey, for example, is a wonderful poet at Welsh, and he writes some very interesting poetry. And I've got several books now which I've collected of doctors' rhymes. And Tom Gibson, I have to tell you, is, and those of you who know Tom's poems, it's just magic. I mean, that will, I think, form a little bit of this. Do you want to say anything about doctors' writers?
The thing that really interests me in this, I don't know this subject anywhere near as well as Sir Kenneth does, but Bridie's The Anatomist, which you might be familiar with, about the grave snatchers and the early anatomists, is just, it's the most powerful thing I think you could read about that era. And quite, well, you'll know better than me, hopefully quite realistic.
I think it is. I mean, it's a great book, and Jerry Carruthers, who's the head of the Department of Scottish Literature, has written a little book about Bridie and his work. So there's a lot of literature in this. Indeed, one of my, I mean, I've got the sort of slightly medical background and sort of history of medicine background, the Scottish literature background. I mean, the reason I wanted to do an MLit was I wanted to meet people like this who knew more than I did about the range and the way into it, rather than just indiscriminately reading. And it's been fascinating what I've identified. How many of you have read Memoirs of a Justified Sinner? I mean, it's a terrible book in some ways. it's the man who's the elect, and he does terrible, depraved things because he's got this calling. What I didn't know until I met Jerry Carruthers was that after it was published, it must be in the early 19th century, I think, it was not reprinted at all. People thought it was so bad. And it was only after the Second World War, post-Auschwitz, that a French publisher decided that this was a good thing to release again, to let people see how depravity and depraved things could be. Now, that's the kind of information which your average jobbing surgeon doesn't know. But it's quite interesting to get that kind of background, which is why I'm quite interested in being part of the department, because it gives me a range which I might not normally have.
Well, it is the tradition that the joint meeting for the president of the visiting society to deliver the vote of thanks, but these are iconoclastic times, and tonight we inaugurate a new tradition of the vote of thanks being delivered by the vice president. So, Dr. Hazel Scott.
Okay, Sir Kenneth, we continue to be amazed at how you've made your own career an exposition of moving beyond where you are, and indeed we wonder if you will ever stop trying to improve yourself. We've been delighted to listen tonight to your sang rather than to a sermon, and we've also been very grateful to Dr. Brown for her fluent Scots tongue bringing together so and to life so many of these extracts in a way that we would have found, I think, many of us difficult to achieve ourselves. And Sir Kenneth, you, like us, are clearly fascinated by the recurrence over generations of key issues. And as doctors, we often pride ourselves on all that defines our generation and all that is evidence-based, and yet it seems we continue to wrestle with many of the same problems that our forefathers have done. And I do wonder if your studies will reveal whether there's any hope of us moving beyond where we are and of us improving ourselves in this context. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope that you have enjoyed this evening as much as I have, and I ask you to show your appreciation in the usual manner.